So what we're doing this morning, right, what she just read for you is a vision. So I want us to make sure that we're getting in the vision, so we have to engage our imaginations, right? You saw from Jesus through John a dragon standing on the sand of the sea. So I want you to picture in your mind standing on the shore of the Mediterranean and Aegean seas, what in today would be modern-day Turkey, on the western coast of modern-day Turkey, just a little bit from the town of Ephesus in John's day. And so here stands this mighty dragon, right, looking out at the waters, and in a moment, he's going to look back over his other shoulder at the land. And in the waters, he sees a beast rising from the waters, what we covered last week. And he gives to that beast the power of his throne and great authority and power. And he says, rise up. And he sends that beast onto the land. And he says, I want you to make war. I want you to make war on all the saints and all those who believe in Jesus. And I want you to make it a war of violence and oppression. And I want you to conquer. And then he looks over his shoulder and he sees another beast rising from the earth. And this beast is different. Where this beast uses violence and power and authority and might and the fist, this is the beast of propaganda. This is the beast of worship. If this is the God, this is the priest. This beast doesn't use violence and the harsh hand to begin with, at least. This beast uses deception and illusion and subtlety and trickery and bewitching of people to believe certain things that they wouldn't otherwise believe, to fall down and worship the first beast. And if that doesn't work, if deception and illusion and magic tricks won't work, then economic coercion will do. These are the two beasts and the dragon that every morning you wake up, you are facing. All right, so get this image on the scene, this unholy trinity. Right, they're just coming against us. And there should be a certain kind of fear that we should have of these beasts. But here's what's brilliant about Jesus. Even though this is a story and a vision, Jesus is really structured and clear about how we're supposed to face this threat to our existence. And it's right there even in the story, because we hear about the first beast rising up from the sea in chapter 13, verses 1 through 9. And then in verse 10, we're given this partial response. Like, how are we going to come against this threesome that's coming against us, that Jesus is saying, this is a fearsome threesome, but it's not indomitable. And how you're going to face the first beast rising up out of the sea is, I want my holy people to passionately stand fast and endure and be faithful. And then there's this second beast that we're going to dig in just a moment this morning in chapter 13, verses 11 through 17, right? And we see the description there of that beast. But then what do we get in verse 18? Same thing, readiness. How can I be ready? And see, and this is no accident. He uses a very particular Greek word at the beginning of verse 10 and the beginning of verse 18. And he's going to use it again in chapter 14 and again in chapter 17. It's the word hodah. It means this or here. So when you see this beast, this calls for patient endurance rising up out of the sea. When you see that beast, when you see this beast rising up out of the earth, this calls, this thing, this reality, this beast specifically calls for wisdom. You see, the careful listener, which is what we are, right, family? So we got different weapons we got to bring against different enemies. So that's what we're going to dig into in the second beast this morning. Let's pray and ask his help. Father, we just pray again in line with verse 9 of chapter 13 of the vision from your son. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. And we think back to chapter 2 and 3 and those seven letters to the churches where Jesus said that over and over again, if anyone has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And so Father, Son, and Spirit, we stand, we sit here, we're online, we're listening because we need you to equip us against this unholy trinity that comes against this far more powerful and holy Trinity to strengthen us and equip us. So come, Spirit, do that. Open our eyes and our ears in Jesus' name. Amen. So I argued to you last week, if you didn't see last week's sermon, please go do that. It'll help you understand how these beasts in this Trinity is working together. I argued last week that the beast in John's day, being described in this vision, that the monster was Rome. And that reality continues here, right? So I just want to make sure that you remember that context. I think what Jesus is on about is he's showing us now in these two beasts the difference between the kinds of power that Rome brought to oppress peoples, how that worked out on the ground in places like Ephesus and Smyrna, Pergamum and Thyatira, Sardis and Philadelphia and Laodicea, the places and people who are receiving this letter the first time round, right? Like Jesus was trying to equip real people in real places against a real power and pagan empire. So that was the first beast. I didn't see this last week, but I think here's what's going on. Because I asked myself the question, what's the difference between coming out of the sea and coming out of the earth? And what hit me is, well, how did Rome send out its invading armies to spread its empire and its power across the sea to different lands? So the first beast rising up out of the sea is this representation of the invading armies of Rome. And then the second beast now rising up out of the earth is the power of Rome made local. I think it's how the land operates is locally. It's the expression of that empire now on local soil. In John's day, that was the imperial cult, right? Who built temples to the pantheon of gods worshipped by the Romans, chief among them, the emperor himself. Sacrifice in John's day to Nero. And it was the priests of Rome who built images of those gods in those temples, who used cheap parlor trickery to make them seemingly move and talk and convince people that the gods were real, that the god Caesar himself would reside in those actual idols built in the temples, ever ready to bless, ever ready to bring prosperity to you. If you would just bow the knee to the state, all the riches and the wealth and the power of Rome can be yours. And it was they who, with great persuasion and with powerful signs, verse 14, would deceive those who dwell on the earth. So in other words, they're not necessarily providing a reasoned case for empire. They are using signs and images to seduce and threaten and impress and overwhelm the peoples of the earth. Now, how was that possible? How could they do that? Where did that power come from? Well, Jesus tells John. It was the dragon who gave the power to the first beast and the first beast who gave the power to the second. So the reason Jesus here reveals for us is so that we do not underestimate the powers of darkness and the signs that they can perform and the things that they can bring about in order to deceive and get people to worship, right? Like, let's not forget the story that we keep telling ourselves of, like, this is the wilderness time, right? They're sent out into the wilderness. That's what it's hearkening back to. And when the children of Israel, God's people, were sent out into the wilderness from the great Satan, Pharaoh, right? That serpent who had tried to deceive them and oppress them. Do you remember what happened in the story when Pharaoh came up against the God of Israel? Did he not himself had magicians who would give signs and powerful works opposed to Moses and Aaron as they were giving signs from God to say, fine, you can do tricks, we can do tricks too. You have power, we have power too. Worship Pharaoh. He's the God that will deliver you. He's the God you should bend the knee to. And these beastly strategies, friends, have not changed, nor has their effectiveness for thousands and thousands of years, these strategies of the beasts. So our task in this day is to be aware of the imperial cult of today. It's to recognize the priests of the empire of America. So maybe Maybe it is the religion of secularism with its priests who argue the case of a world without God, a kind of meism, right? Which places self on the altar to be worshiped. The power to decide is bound up in me and my truth, right? Who's heard that? Hey, you just got to have your truth. You be you. The role of the empire is to set me free to be whoever I want to be, to do whatever I want to do and provide. That empire should provide for whatever I want. So make your desires your God, bow down to them, sacrifice to them, actualize your identity to find happiness and fulfillment. And oh, how many followers and worshipers does the God of secularism have? Or as we discussed last week, right? Maybe it is the false God of political tribalism with its own soteriology, a method of delivering salvation from all of the evils of the world. Here it may be that the first beast is party. The worship space is the convention and political rally. The sacred documents are party platform. The priests are its majority leaders and party whips and campaign managers. Its gods are its candidates and its images are elephant and donkey. And so much of what they are preaching is meant unconsciously or consciously in the grip of the first beast and the evil one. Orchestrating those beasts to get people to worship, to get people to believe that they're the ones who can save you. They come looking like lambs, the text says, but they speak with the tongue of a serpent. They come, as Jesus said, right, long before this vision, when he was ministering here on earth, they come in sheep's clothing, while in fact they are ravenous wolves. Matthew chapter 7. The work of the second beast is more subtle, but make no mistake, friends, it is just as deadly. Do we not see around us people bewitched by arguments and promises? No sign or miracle, like maybe you're thinking, you know, like you see in this, in the biblical story, no sign or miracle is needed. Just the promise of an idealized future that can't be delivered, right? Like they're promising this idealized future and people are falling sway under those promises and that deception, but that future can only be delivered by Christ. Theirs is not magic, maybe, but it is illusion. And it is illusory. One historian said it this way of how this was working in John's day. Worshiping and not worshiping was quickly becoming the dividing line between people who were acceptable in the community and people who weren't. Did you catch that? So worshiping and not worshiping was becoming the dividing line between people who were acceptable in the community and people who weren't. So many local officials introduced the formal requirement that unless you offered the required sacrifices, you weren't allowed in the marketplace. There were various kinds of marks and visible signs which were used to set people apart, either as able to trade or not able to trade. From quite early on, Christians faced a stark alternative. Stay true to the Lamb and risk your livelihood and the ability to buy or sell or capitulate to the monster, sacrifice to Caesar at the behest of local officials, and everything will be all right. That was the choice. So if you won't listen to the deceptive arguments and worship, go our way, then we will use economic coercion to bring you in to line. In their day, that may have meant trying to navigate if it was a compromise, to use money with Caesar's image, with the Son of God, Caesar's image and the Son of God stamped on it. In their day, it was trying to navigate if they could put their stall out by the side of the road, you know, during one of the great imperial festivals where all the worshiping was going on and thousands would pass by. Is it right to put a stall out and sell your wares and get money from the festival to a false god? They had to navigate. Is it right to buy a slab of beef in the market, even though I know it's been offered as a sacrifice to Caesar? And are we not faced, Christians, with the same challenges of economic coercion in our day to get us to fall in line with the empire and how it flexes its beliefs through its cult-like influence in our culture at times it doesn't flex its muscle, but rather it follows the prevailing mob in what it wants, to just go along with the mob and then wants to force us to do the same? Isn't this the threat? If you comply and do as we say and follow the program, you can share in the bounty and prosperity of America. But if you resist, you will be excluded. You will be branded. You will be blackballed. It is the local expression of empire in Washington State who says, make the flower arrangement, decorate the space, accept and adorn our sacrament of so-called same-sex marriage, or lose everything, possessions, money, business, livelihood, and maybe your freedom. And it is the diminutive, silver-haired florist named Baronelle who resists. It is the local expression of empire in the form of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, who says to the baker, bake the cake or else, who brings him to the highest court of the empire. It is the quiet baker named Jack Phillips who resists, who says, I can't, who explains that to do so would mean breaking allegiance to the lamb and swearing allegiance to the beast. It is the local expression of the empire in the form of the Minnesota Human Rights Act that demands a video, film, and production company run by Calvary members Carl and Angel Larson demands that they make films of same-sex marriages if they're going to do that for people who marry in the way that we believe is truly marriage. Make the video or else fines, civil penalties, maybe jail. And they resist. And it's not just the florist or the baker or the video maker. We could go on and on with so many examples, couldn't we? Medical practitioners disagreeing with transgenderism and sex change surgeries, fired. Professors who are willing to teach a diversity of beliefs and who try to shed light on the truth, fired. Farmers unable to sell food at farmers' markets because they hold to Christian beliefs. Student athletes defending the right to compete against opponents of the same biological sex and not someone of the opposite sex, removed from competition. And on and on and on we could go. You see, the point isn't a literal mark. Don't get bound up in that in the text. It's a symbol, and it's pointing to something else that Mark spoken of in the text. The point is that the beast demands a sign, yes, but a sign of our allegiance. We live in the time of the mob. Resist, and you will be canceled, or worse. Acquiesce, support, approve, and you will be accepted, and everything will be okay, and you will be allowed to continue to participate. The bounty and the freedoms of America can be yours. And it isn't merely state power from across the sea for us, is it? It's peer pressure rising up from the land that you call home and the spaces that you operate in, pressing in on you to bend the knee in worship. What will be the challenges that you have to face? What do you think are going to be the decisions that you will need to make in your business, in your neighborhood, in your association, in your club, at your workplace? And will you acquiesce when the demand is against the demands of Christ? Will you put up the yard sign? Will you wear the t-shirt? Will you repeat the slogan? Will you capitulate to the religion? Will you retweet the symbol or repost the mantra? Will you acquiesce or will you resist? How will you do so? These are powerful forces, friends. These aren't easy questions that we're going to have to wrestle with. We could be headed, as I said last week, into very difficult days as Christians in the West. We could be facing what our brothers and sisters in third world countries face. We could be needing to figure out how to support those who have lost jobs and livings and are unable to function in the marketplace that God had called them to. Are we ready to do that? How will we be ready? Well, Jesus gives us three really key and powerful ways to be ready in chapter 14. So be reading that, because probably the next three sermons or so are going to be unpacking that. That's a full-throated view. But he gives us, right, what I said at the beginning, he gives us these partial ways to come against these. The first is passionately stand, be faithful, and endure against the first beast. And how do I come against a beast that's more subtle in nature, tries to get me to worship, says things that sound so good and promises that seem like they're going to deliver? How do I get ready for that? And how do I help people around me not be bewitched by that kind of thinking and talking? Well, doesn't it make perfect sense that Jesus would say in verse 18, this calls that kind of beast with that kind of power for subtlety and illusion and deception, this calls for wisdom and understanding. You see, coming against violence calls for a certain steeling of the spine. Coming against subtlety and deception calls for wisdom to be able to see through the argumentation, right? It calls for the mind to be engaged. I have to think about the arguments that are being made. So that calls, I got to pray, God, help me to have wisdom to come against this. Well, isn't that remarkable? And absolutely brilliant. Here's what I think Jesus is saying. If I were to take the role of Jesus and put words in his mouth, which is a great risk, here's what I think he's saying. The second beast, brother, sister, is the beast of propaganda, of deception, of false images and false promises, of holding out prosperity and seemingly asking so little. Come on. Bake the cake. Make the flowers. Do the video. What's the big deal? Just go along. You'll get along. Why would you want to be on the wrong side of history? The second beast comes promising so much and delivering nothing but misery and death, but he's really good at it. And so this calls for wisdom, this calls for understanding, this demands insight to see sheep in wolves' clothing and lambs with dragons' hearts and tongues, mere parodies of all that I am and all that I offer, both presently and one day soon. You see, Jesus says, I alone am perfection. You know what I've been telling you in this vision, all these number sevens, which is a representation of my perfection. And I am not merely perfection, but I am super perfection. We are the Holy Trinity. You could say 777. And I need you to see right through this beast from the earth. I need you to go to the sea and to see that the empire and all the charlatans that go along with them, they are merely men. They are so imperfect. They fall so short of my perfection. You see, they are so flawed. They are triple flawed. I want you to see that as apart from me, who is 777, they are 666. They fall short in every possible category and way. So you will have choices to make and questions to face, and they won't always be clear cut. That's the way it's always been for my people, says Jesus. So you must pray for discernment to distinguish my reality from false parody and to act accordingly. You will need to patiently endure and hold to the faith and wisely resist the deceptions and the coercion. Are you ready? I was listening to a podcast by a pastor in Moscow, Idaho, this week, whose name is Douglas Wilson. Here's how he said it. This is just so helpful to me this week. In this crazy time of ours, he said, complacency is out. If you used to just live in such a way that you could specialize, I can just focus on my own dental practice, my own job at the hardware store, being a software engineer, that you could just focus on that, just worry about getting your family to church on the weekend, which I hope you do in increasing fashion, that you could just be devoted to your profession, you could just trust the rest of the world to do their job, the president, the governor, the mayor, council people, evangelical leaders even, that you can just stay put and not think about all the rest of it. Maybe that's how you're thinking that you can live. Well, what has happened in the last 6 months is that Christians, many of whom never learned how to really swim, have been pitched into the deep end of the pool. And Jesus, I would add to Douglas, that's exactly what he's making clear in this revelation. Here's how Wilson said it before, right? Like you could go to a store and just buy a gallon of milk. You just did that. Now, there's mandates about how you do that, which forces you to have to go to Romans 13 and understand what that means, to think through the limits of political authority, of civil resistance, to contemplate some of your friends going in this direction and some of your friends going in that direction. See, it used to be that everyone just was doing their own job and things kind of stayed in their place and you didn't have to worry about it or think about it, right? You could just count on certain things. But that's not true anymore. I'll rip off another of Wilson's illustrations. He talked about it's like being on a baseball field. And we're all at least a little familiar, even if you haven't played, you're a little familiar with baseball. And right, if I'm the third baseman on a baseball field, and the bases are loaded, and there's a batter up, and there's one out, I have to be aware of everything that's going on that field. I need to be aware of what if he hits a single? What if he does a bunt? What if it's a pop fly? What do I do when any of those instances happen? I have to be aware of everything going on the field, thinking all the time. In other words, as a third baseman, you need wisdom. You need understanding. You need to see things the way that they are and be ready to do something about them when they happen, which is exactly what Jesus is saying about you right now in the life you are living. You have to be a thinking Christian. Complacency is out. You don't get to not care. You have to be ready for whatever is going to happen. You should be asking questions. Where do I go to find answers like that? What should I be reading? What should I be listening to? What am I going to do maybe if things get better or God forbid, what if they get far worse? What are you going to do on November 3rd? What are you going to do on November 4th? You don't have an option to not be thinking this through, family. Not all of you, but I hope increasingly many of you would be able to call yourselves members of this family, members of Calvary Community Church, churchgoers, followers of Jesus, your fathers, your mothers, your brothers, your sisters. You have a number of roles to play that God has called you to play, and you have been placed by God in each one of those positions, and complacency, carelessness, not being sufficiently thoughtful, slackness, lackness, laziness. Friends, that's all out. Let's just be done with all of that, okay? Worship team, would you come up? And you can't, listen, you can do this. because you do not serve a beast who feigns a mortal wound, verse 12, seemingly coming alive from the dead. You serve a lamb whose sacred head was actually wounded unto death and has risen from the grave to be your living hope. To be your living hope. So what you're supposed to do when a great dragon and beast one and beast two comes against you is you're supposed to sing out, your salvation is found in no other, and you serve the king. And this lamb that was slain has risen from the dead and has more power than all y'all. And we're not afraid, right? That's our response. That's what you're going to do right now. So stand, would you? You're going to stand and you're going to sing the gospel. You're going to sing the good news. And the dragon and the beasts are listening, family. So sing loud.